I like it. Here comes Rick Steves. He likes to get away, right, Rick?
I love to get away.
It's so great to have you on the show today on WILK to talk about your new book, Travel as a Political Act, How to Leave Your Baggage Behind, and the things you do to empower people to see our big blue marble. So thanks so much for doing the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be with you.
When did you realize at first, Rick, that it was possible for you to travel? Were you a young person, and what excited you about seeing other things?
I had no interest in traveling as a kid until my dad decided to import pianos from Germany, and he came home one day and he said, "Son, we're going to Germany to see the piano factories." And I thought, that's a stupid idea. But I got over there and I realized it's a fascinating world. And I went a couple of times with my parents as a kid, and I vowed to go back every year after that on my own, and I've done that, and I've spent 4 months a year in Europe since the 70s, and now I'm really enjoying writing guidebooks and making TV shows and encouraging Americans to basically get beyond Orlando.
Your television show is so visually stunning. Oh my goodness, Rick. It is. I bet it's better in person, but it looks great on TV.
Well, I've got a great crew, and it's a beautiful sort of setting. I mean, Europe is my beat, and for me, Europe is the wading pool for world exploration. And I really like to go over there and make the mistakes, take careful notes. When I get ripped off, I celebrate. They don't know who they just ripped off. I'm going to come home and teach my fellow Americans that scam so that when they go over there to Europe, they can travel smarter and enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar in their vacation. And I've been doing that, for a long, long time. Now I've got, a staff of about 150 people here in Seattle helping me produce and amplify my teaching. And I've got technology beyond my wildest dreams to help me share the lessons I've learned from my travels. And I've realized lately that it's really, I think, very valuable for Americans to get out of their comfort zone and travel in places where they're able to gain an empathy for the other 96% of humanity and come home with what I think is the most beautiful souvenir, and that's a broader perspective.
You say fear is for people who don't get out much, and I agree that some people are so intimidated by all kinds of things regarding travel. But as you just mentioned, Rick, now in this age that we live in, there's more technology available. If something goes wrong, my goodness, you can certainly get on your phone and try to figure it out or Google it. How has that made people less timid about getting out there?
Oh, I think, I've been teaching this for decades, and the language barrier is much easier now. Anybody who's educated or young or in tourism is very likely to speak English. I speak only English. It's nothing to brag about it, but it's the language that works. Of course, we've got instant communication, almost free anywhere now, and that was a huge challenge when I started traveling, was just communicating with your loved ones back home. Transportation is so much easier and safer now. I mean, in the old days, it took a train ride, a boat ride, sniffed by dogs, another train ride to get from London to Paris. And now there's it's 2.5 hours by train, 17 minutes on the English Channel. It's just a delight. So, a lot of people are wondering about safety and so on. It's in any measure, it's safer today than it was 20 or 30 years ago to travel, outside of our country. But one thing we have different now is 24/7 commercial news media that tends to make us frightened. So as you mentioned, fear is for people who don't get out very much, and I'm afraid the most frightened people in our society are the ones buried deep in the middle of it with no passports. I know that the flip side of fear is understanding, and we gain understanding through travel. And considering the complicated and important challenges facing our nation today, it's more important than ever that we get out and get to know the rest of the world.
And you have in your book the statistics about terrorism and, this kind of probability. Because, when we see something happening overseas, Rick, in a place like Paris, we think to ourselves, wow, that scratch that one off. But if we thought like that, I mean, we'd never set foot in New York City again. And I go there all the time and I don't really think too much about it. So I guess we just have to think more broadly about this, right?
Well, we need to think a little more cerebrally and less emotionally about it. I mean, we have to also remember news is these days, news is entertainment masquerading as news. News has to make money. In the old days, news didn't need to make money. It was the networks would contribute the news hour to our democracy without having to make a profit. Well, those days are gone now, and everything's corporate, and everything's got a legal obligation to profit maximize for its stockholders in the short term. So you can't give the news to our country anymore, and you got to amp it up and sex it up and bloody it up and crisis it up, and so you get more eyeballs and you can charge more for your ads. And, you know, entertainment's kind of fun, but it shouldn't make us a frightened nation. And I just love the thought of getting out there and getting out of walloping your ethnocentricity. I just love to hang out with smart people who do things differently than me. And when I come home, I don't need to do it their way, but at least I know that reasonable people can differ on this kind of stuff. And for me, I've been, you know, I've written 50 guidebooks all over Europe. We take 20,000 people on a 1,000 tours through my company in Europe. And once you get over there, you realize it's safe. It's just a shame that people make a small terrorist bomb a big terrorist bomb by overreacting to it. You really got to keep it in perspective. Bad things happen. 1,000 people are killed in Nashville every year, I understand, but we still go to Nashville. If something terrible happens in Europe, it's a free society. There's 400 million people there. You take the risk, you go have a good time, and you realize, you know, when somebody tells me have a safe trip, I'm more inclined to say, well, you have a safe stay at home, because where I'm going is statistically, and I know statistics are optional these days, but where I'm going is safer than where you're staying. I'm heading off to Europe every year for 4 months, and I just love it over there.
Let's talk about the impression that people in some foreign lands have of Americans these days. What's true and what's false? I mean, how are people perceiving us?
Oh, you know, if Europeans voted for our president, we'd always have a democratic president. I mean, Europeans are just more liberal and more concerned with how the government can contribute to the fabric of their democracies and so on. And a lot of Americans just really believe in this small government and that sort of ideal. And, you know, it's not a simple answer. It's no right or wrong. But Europeans kind of roll their eyes at our president right now. But I'll tell you, there's no downside to traveling now because of what's going on in our country politically. The ideals of America, you know, pluralism, democracy, hard work, you know, capitalism, these kind of ideals of what America's all about, they're shining examples on the hill for any Western-looking democratic society, certainly in Europe. And it's just fun for us to get over there. And I think the great thing about travel is, and I talk about that in my book, Travel as a Political Act, when we travel, we humanize the world. We gain an empathy for people south of our border or far away. It makes it tougher for them, for their government to demonize us with their propaganda when they know who we are. And it also, when we go home, it makes it tougher for our government to demonize or dehumanize them with our propaganda. And it's just, you know, what really distinguishes a good trip is how many people you meet. If I'm working on a TV script or leading a tour or writing a guidebook, the mark of what kind of a job I'm doing, I think, is how can I connect my travelers with real people in another country? Because that's really what distinguishes and makes it carbonates the whole experience.
Very good. Now let's talk about if we do want to travel in the upcoming months, where our money goes really, really far. Do you see? Because a lot of the people who live here, Rick, are a little bit on the tight side. So can you talk about maybe some places where you could get a really great bang for your buck right about now?
Well, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking, where's my dollar going to go the farthest? I spend a lot of time thinking about where are my travel dreams taking me and how can I travel smartly in that place. If you've always wanted to visit relatives in Norway and somebody tells you that Portugal is a lot cheaper, well, of course Portugal is cheaper, but you want to go to Norway to see your relatives. I would say if you're thinking about how can you stretch your dollar, you're going to pay $10 to go into that museum one way or another. If you know a little bit about what you're going to see, you'll enjoy it twice as much. You know, I've spent my lifetime teaching people how to stretch their dollars overseas, and you can find alternatives to hotels and restaurants and eat and sleep perfectly well in the most expensive countries anywhere, and you can travel cheaper in those countries than you could in a, quote, cheap country. Having said that, you know, there's to the south and to the east, things are cheaper. If you go to Greece or you go to Portugal or you go to Spain, it's going to be a lot cheaper than Britain or Scandinavia. But, you know, there's so many things now that enable us to travel really efficiently. There's discount airlines. In the old days, nobody would fly point to point in Europe. And now, you know, a flight is cheaper than a bus or a train ride if you know how to get a good flight. Airbnb makes sleeping in bed and breakfasts really competitive compared to hotels. And there's efficiencies, like we don't need to change money when we cross borders these days because nearly everybody has the same euro coins jangling in their pockets. So there's a lot of efficiencies. I like to fly open jaws. I think it's been 10 years since I flew in and out of the same city. Fly into one city and out of another city. Then you don't have to spend the time and the money to return to your starting point. You have to decide, are you going to take a train, are you going to drive? And those are important issues. If there's a group of you, it's much cheaper by car. If you're one or two, it's probably cheaper by train. If you're going from big city to big city to big city, a car is a worthless headache. You don't want a car. You want to take the train. If you're tooling around the countryside, that's where you want a car because public transportation would be more frustrating. If you are one of these people that has to pack heavy, I'm always preaching packing light. If you're not going to pack light, well, you should rent a car. You know, you could even rent a trailer. But if you're going to pack light, then the train makes a lot of sense. So there's all these variables, and those are things that I talk about in my guidebooks, and those are the lessons you learn from your experience. And what I love to do is spend 120 days a year in Europe. I've done that for 30 years, and I'm just taking notes, making mistakes, hitting and missing, designing all the hits, bringing them home so people can have a better batting average in their travels.
And you certainly go to some places, Rick, that some people may say, I don't think I should go there. But what are some countries that you've been to that people think are inherently very, very dangerous and you found them to be quite the pleasure?
Well, Sue, first of all, I want to say I would never advocate going to a dangerous place. I've scouted a TV show for Egypt. I've wanted to go there for several years now, but I don't think it's comfortable for American travelers in Egypt right now as much as I'd like it to be, so I'm going to wait on that. But I've been in Iran, I've been in Palestine, I've been in Turkey and Morocco and Russia. And these are in Cuba. These are exciting destinations, they're totally open for travel. And the Lonely Planet guidebooks I don't write to these guidebooks to these countries, but I use Lonely Planet, and those guidebooks sell quite well. And Americans think you can't go to Iran or you can't go to Cuba. Well, Americans have that problem, but everybody else goes there and loves it. Cuba is the number one Caribbean destination for Germans and Canadians. Once you get there, then you realize, oh my goodness, here's an alternative viewpoint. And I just love to get both narratives. We did a TV show on the Holy Land, and I'm adamant about anybody who goes to the Holy Land should spend time in Israel and then in Palestine, in the West Bank. And you get to hear, perspectives from both sides of that wall. Is it dangerous? No. Is it poor and hard scrabble and lots of broken things and a little bit of chaos in the streets in Palestine? Yes. It's like going from San Diego to Tijuana. It's, people make 10 times as much money on one side of the wall between America and Mexico, and they make 10 times as much money on one side of the wall between Israel and Palestine. So you're going to find nicer roads and people that spend more money on soap on one side of the wall, but you've got beautiful, hardworking people on the other side of the wall that you can meet also.
You also take on something that I guess most travel aficionados don't, and that's drug policy, which I think is very interesting. And I want you to talk a little bit about that as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm an advocate of stop taking the crime out of the drug policy equation. I was one of the sponsors and spokespeople on the team in Washington State when 6 years ago we legalized, taxed, and regulated marijuana. Washington State and Colorado were the first states to do that. Every 2 years I go on the road and spend a lot of money and spend a lot of my time in different states trying to help those states understand the tragedy of our war on marijuana and the wisdom of legalizing, taxing, and regulating it. I'm certainly not pro-marijuana. I'm just pro-smart drug policy and pro-civil liberties and kind of into pragmatic harm reductions rather than moralizing and incarceration. My perspective is shaped by my time in Europe, where a joint's about as exciting as a can of beer. And my friends in Europe have explained to me there's just no correlation between how strict the laws are and how much consumption you have. I mean, there's not a reservoir of decent people that would love to ruin their lives smoking pot if only it was legal. And that was my hunch. And in Washington State, 6 years ago, we we legalized marijuana. And when we did, the marijuana industry in our state was huge. It was rivaling apples, and that's a big deal in Washington State. And our hunch was when we legalized, we would not see an increase in use of marijuana. We would just turn it into a highly regulated and highly taxed industry, taking all that money that was empowering gangs and organized crime away from that black market and turning it into a good market. And that's exactly what we've done. 4 years later, the track record is in. Washington has legalized marijuana. We have taken the black market down. We have seen statistically that use has not gone up among adults. Use has not gone up among teens. DUIs have not gone up. Crime has not gone up. What has gone up is tax revenue. We've taken that black market industry, turned it into a legal one. And this year, last year, my government arrested 10,000 fewer people, and we got $300 million in tax revenue in Washington State alone, not because more people are smoking pot, but because that money is no longer going into the black market. So this is just a smart policy thing that we're doing, and I'll be going to several states on the East Coast in the next week, advocating in state houses to take the crime out of the equation and get smart about marijuana policy. But again, that's something you learn in your travels, because I go to Europe, and the countries with the biggest opioid problem in the last decades have been Portugal and the Netherlands, and they've tackled their opioid problem in part by essentially legalizing marijuana and getting credibility for their law enforcement and focusing on hard drug abuse. In those languages, the word for addicted is enslaved. People who are addicted to hard drugs are not criminals. They're sick people. They don't need handcuffs and cops and judges and lawyers. They need compassion. They need counseling, and they need nurses. And that's a smart European approach to this persistent problem that I think we can learn from. And I'm proud to be a spokesperson in that regard.
Will you be coming to Pennsylvania, Rick, or not?
I'm going to Maryland and New Jersey and Washington, D.C. and Vermont. On this trip, I was in Massachusetts and Maine on the last election. We've run out of basically all the initiative states have legalized marijuana now. It's, on a hot issue like that where politicians don't want to risk their reputation, they don't want to be, quote, soft on drugs. That's what the initiative process is for. So California, Washington, Massachusetts, Maine, and so on, they're all initiative states. Now we're into states where you have to go through the legislative branch. So, and now it's not such a dicey issue because people are realizing that it's a racist, non-productive, dishonest law, this prohibition against marijuana. And one by one, states are recognizing that. And my commitment in this regard, just as a caring citizen, is to every 2 years go on the road and help through organizations that are working to end the prohibition against marijuana. And I don't You're in Pennsylvania. I don't think Pennsylvania is considered one of the states that are ready to go yet.
It's getting closer, though. We got to let you go because I looked at the clock, and we have to keep you on your schedule, and that's important.
Oh, that's great. Hey, nice talking to you, and I hope we can talk again.
Yeah, thanks, Rick Steves. We appreciate it.